You're listening to an M Pavilion podcast. We acknowledge the people of the Eastern Kulin Nation as the traditional custodians of the land on which M Pavilion stands. We pay our respects to their elders past and present, and extend that respect to the traditional custodians of the land where you're tuning in from, around Australia and across the globe.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming. My name is Taryn Shi, and I'm a graduate landscape architect at 3 Acres Landscape Architecture. And I'm also working as a sessional tutor at Melbourne School of Design. I was born and raised in the southern west city in China. I came to Melbourne for my Bachelor of Design degrees in 2018. And then after that is Master of Landscape Architecture. So I really hated landscape architecture when I graduated from my undergrad because I was sort of really sad that I was doomed to be a mediocre designer. But then I got into my master's degree because graduated in 2020 was a very horrible situation for international students. So I just went straight into my master's degree, and then I happened to take this theory subject, which really opened up my mind, and I started to question what's the meaning of practice for design students. So as an international student who's paying a crazy amount of tuition fees, can we do something else rather than just graduate with a degree and then practice in an office? So, and also we're receiving so little help from us from the industry or the school to help us integrate it into the industry. So that's a little bit for me. So I'm working part-time and also organizing this event and doing some other writing and editorial stuff alongside, try to enrich my practice rather than only as a someone working on AutoCAD. So here.
I'm Inuri Lienage. I'm a graduate of architecture at Pedavoli Architects. I did my bachelor's and master's at Monash. I'm from Sri Lanka, and I also grew up in a few other South Asian countries before coming to Melbourne in 2017 for my studies. Studying architecture was unexpectedly intense. Unlike my high school friends who had a more gradual ascend to their finals week, as I was saying, despite the pressure, I did enjoy architecture because I genuinely enjoyed it and because university taught me a lot. But as Taryn pointed out, the transition into the industry was particularly nerve-wracking. The challenge is common for design graduates, but it felt even more daunting for international students where time or lack of played a significant role.
Okay, so for this, why we're holding this event is because Inura and I, we met in the mid-2023. There's a M Curator program that's hosted by M Pavilion, which has helped to support young design and art practitioners to curate their own event at M Pavilion. So we were both international students, back then struggling to get a job in the industry. So we were thinking, why not just invite other more experienced women to come and share their stories? And how has gender and migration brought opportunities, barriers, and inequalities to us? So here's why we're doing this. And also, lastly, before we officially start, we would like to thank those people who helped Inuri and I along the way of breaking into the industry. We would like to thank them to use this event as an opportunity to give back to this very supportive community. So now let's welcome our speakers. We'll briefly introduce them before they fully unpack themselves.
So first we have Sonia Sarangi. She is the director of the architecture firm Endeavour and a tutor of Melbourne School of Design. As a child of South Asian immigrants in the Middle East, Sonia made her own path to Singapore and now finally in Melbourne, where her practice is deeply shaped through her multiple journeys.
And then we have Aning Kuswinari. She is an Indonesian landscape architect working at TCL. Her love for travel, passion for the environment, conservation, and interest in landscape ecology have inspired her design journey to Singapore, Scotland, New Zealand, and now Australia.
And we finally have Karen Miner. She's a student of landscape architecture and urban planning at Melbourne School of Design. Originally from Kenya, Karen is passionate about the empowerment, recognition, and celebration of African designers and practitioners.
Okay, so before we start, we would like to remind everyone that there's no right or wrong answer to the questions. What's important is to give voice to and celebrate the diversity of our built environment industry. So now, can you please share your stories and tell us what prompted you to come to Australia for study and work? You can also talk about what is different from what you've expected before you arrive, and what was your arrival like then, and how it's different from now.
Okay, I'll go first. So I started thinking about migration to Australia, Melbourne, in around 2005, and the reasons were actually burnout. I was working in a large practice in Singapore, and architecture practice was not living up to the ideals. The long hours work culture exists everywhere. So it's not uniquely a Singapore issue. So I started looking into whether I should go leave architecture altogether or switch discipline. But then there was this tiny voice in the back of my mind that said, what if architecture practice or just practice in general is not the same everywhere in this sense? And so I thought I'd give it a shot and do master's in architecture, continue that. And so I decided to come to Australia because, quite frankly, that is what I could afford, or my parents who were helping me with my tuition could afford. The deal was they would help with the tuition, I would cover my living costs. So those were, I suppose, my reasons for coming. What is different then from what I expected? In my previous migration journey to Singapore, and of course I was born and raised in the Middle East, both those settings, because they were, if you think about it, really trade hubs in some sense for centuries, there was a bit more depth and awareness when it came to their own migrant communities there. And so what surprised me when I came here, because the poster says multicultural, but the depth of what that meant was lacking when I got here, which is not surprising when you think about it, given the White Australia policy only ended in the 70s, right? So we're not talking a very long history of dealing with very diverse people. Of course, there was the Asian community before that have paved the way for many of the other migrant communities, but that's what surprised me. So the brochure was not the reality. And what is different then from what I see now? I'll just reflect on the student experience from that point of view. So in 2006, when I arrived here, unwisely, in winter, for someone who was living in Singapore, that was a bit of a shock. What surprised me was that there weren't that many international students. So there was actually extreme excitement on just spotting another international student, especially in the built environment faculty. You were like, oh my God. Most of the international students were in engineering or, you know, different faculties. So you felt like a unicorn within a unicorn. I feel that's a bit different now, at least in the built environment schools. You can tell me otherwise. But I feel like now there's such a strong population or cohort that you can almost actually be in a silo. You can come here and study and be with the same people of the same culture that you were with when you were back home, which is a lost opportunity in some senses, right? So circumstances meant that I had a very diverse group of friends when I came to study in uni, whereas that's not something you necessarily have to do now. You can be quite comfortable in those silos. Of course, the upside of that is you don't feel as lonely with that transposition and not being able to share that culture, right? So those are my initial thoughts.
Hello. So what prompted me to come to Australia? Can everyone hear me actually? Yeah. Migration to Australia for me was actually my fourth migration. So for the past 17 years, I crossed border four times. You can say so. The first one was Singapore. So I moved to Singapore 17 years ago from Indonesia. And that distance-wise, Indonesia to Singapore, that's probably the shortest and the smallest, but that was the biggest migration for me because that was the first time, the most life-changing ones. And then what follows after get easier and easier. So what started it, I was much younger, so it was 20 years ago now, and then kind of I was very early in my career, and then growing up in Indonesia, if you are from that part of the world, most people there, you live in such a, you know, like holidaying overseas, it's not a thing. It's not within your financial means. So I think for me at that time, it was just overseas is a big question mark. I just want to explore. I want to learn. I want to see. It's something that I don't know about. I see it in textbooks in architecture, but I never seen it myself. I just want to see it. So that's what prompted my first migration. Fast forward 10 years. I was very different in my career, you know, in a place in my professional work. I found within that 10 years after, you know, I came to Singapore for study for my master and then worked there. And 10 years just flew by. I found a new passion there. I found out it wasn't pure architecture. It was environmental project, conservation, landscape ecology, all of those. And then that's what gave me fulfillment. And I found a husband. So so that's a big tick. So both of us kind of at that time in our career, we're very happy in Singapore. The project was great. And but we think that it's a time for us to learn again, to learn something new, to actually learn exactly what we love doing now. You know, my background is architecture. My master is related to that as well. But now I love doing this specific landscape architecture project, and I feel like I lack knowledge in that. So what's that prompted my second migration to Scotland and then to New Zealand. But then kind of being married to an Australian, I know that moving to Australia is somewhere down the line. And I guess at that time, you know, when the time comes, sort of like COVID hits and everything, and, you know, like you think about what's the next move for us. The world kind of stood still at that point. And then if we want to make a change, want to make a move again, and the factor of consideration is very different from 20 years ago. So we still want to be ideal. So where the place in the world that we can still be idealistic of in somewhere in that spectrum in terms of values in design, I think what you believe in, and work-life balance. I heard Australia is really good. And then and also just, you know, both of us have aging parents, and 20 years ago it wasn't a factor, but that now we want to live closer to both family. So I guess that's put three together, Australia come to the very top. And that's when we move here. Unfortunately, you know, we read so much about Melbourne, that how sort of lively it is and all the great things, event, festivals. And we move here right into the lockdown. So the first impression was, but the CBD was just dead, no one there. So we move into our Airbnb, no restaurant opened, nothing open. So it was kind of like, you know, like it's for 6 weeks, which is nothing. So the first impression of Melbourne was, yeah, just very quiet. But 2 years down the road, things changed. So now I'm just getting to know in a way that, you know, slowly it's back to how it should be, I think, Melbourne. So that's how I landed in this city. Back to you.
Hello, everyone. So I moved to Melbourne in 2022. Yes, 2022. And the reason why I moved here, to be quite honest, is because I didn't know what to do next. So I had studied landscape architecture in Kenya, and for my undergrad, and I was like, I don't think that there's anything that I feel passionate about that I want to do now. And I was like, what's the next step? And just on a whim, my parents had previously traveled to Australia, and they were like, oh my God, it's wonderful. And I was like, maybe I can go there. So I ended up, I only applied to one uni and I got accepted and I was like, oh, I guess I'm going to Melbourne then. Yeah, but honestly, at the time, it was a big relief for me to have some sort of traction in my life. I think I had grown very sad and like, oh, I don't know what to do next. And I felt like I still want to sort of explore my interests, but I feel really like trapped because the landscape architecture field in Kenya is quite small. And I just honestly didn't know what to do. And I was like avoiding life by going on to do my master's degree. So I ended up at Melbourne Uni. And to show how like undecided I was, I decided to do 2 degrees instead of one. And that's how I ended up doing both landscape architecture and urban planning. And I think my first impression when I got here was, especially going, so I go to Melbourne Uni and I'm in the MSD and there's literally no black people in the MSD. That was very shocking to me because I came from Kenya and everyone is the same color. And then I get to the MSD and I was like, what's this? And, but honestly, after a while, I really got to meet different people and I think that it's great that it's more diverse than it was when you got here because I was shocked. I was like, I thought it would be more diverse than it is now. But I think it's great to hear that it's getting better. And but my impression now is I don't feel so out of place anymore. I think because I've sort of started to know more people and I've met more people that I have common ground with and I've made friends with Australian people, international students, and I just feel like a bit more comfortable. And yeah, I guess that's the difference between then and now.
Thank you. That kind of brings me to my next question. How has your experience pre and post migration shaped your thinking or approach to work?
Definitely different, pre-migration and post-migration. So in Indonesia, work, I mean, I don't speak for anyone and it was a very long time ago, but work is work. I think a lot of, because it's, you know, living costs is very low, very cheap, but it's also earning is not very high either. So you were in this sort of like rat race of just salary, paying what you need, and then it's just like that. So you don't have this luxury to, oh, what is my dream job? I'm going to take this some time off to think about it. And there's no thing like that. So I think as soon as I graduated, I find a job and then stay there and I work. And then that's just kind of things just rolling. And then it's very different, I think, when, you know, I moved to Singapore and then I was very, very lucky, you know, like I didn't experience the burnout that you had and I enjoyed my 10 years there. My company was fantastic. The work-life balance was amazing. The projects were amazing. And I really didn't have any complaint. There was just, that's when I believe that is this actually I could do this for a long time. And when you find a project that or a type of project that you like and you believe in and you can actually keep going, it's actually one of the reasons why I left Indonesia. Is also I was part of a project that I wasn't happy with to be part of. You know, like you know it when you're like, okay, I'm going to work on it, but just don't put my name on it. Like, you know, so it's a little. There's a little bit of that. So it's. I know there's something more that I want to do, but I didn't know what it is back then, you know, in Indonesia. I think by crossing the border and then see what is actually available, and then that's really changed my thinking now. And I guess, like, the longer you're in that kind of... year after year, the project... You know, I can be more selective in a way that... So when you shift office or when you move place, you can be more sort of, you look through the company profile. Is this really what I want to do? Is it really aligned what I'm thinking? So I think in Indonesia, I couldn't do back like something like that. You know, there are more than 200 million of us. If you don't want to do it, they're going to find someone else to do it. You know, like it's just very different. Yeah, I see work very differently now and then.
Did anyone go through a bit of a culture shock?
Well, am I going to start off? I guess for me it was Singapore, the first one, because basically everything was expensive to me. Indonesia is the second lowest currency in the world. So everything outside Indonesia just feel extremely expensive to me. So at some time I'm just like, oh, wow. I usually can eat in $1 to $2 every meal. And then now everything is, I mean, you talk about here, 15 or something, right? So I think as a student, when my stipend or the saving is so limited, I calculated everything. And then, okay, I'm just going to eat. I'm not going to drink. I'm going to go back to my place and then, you know, drink something. It's that point, you know, like it's the culture shock. I think was just prices, but yeah.
Just want to unpack culture shock a little bit because, I mean, I've had two migration journeys too, right? The first to Singapore and the second to here. So it's really hard to explain to someone else who hasn't gone through that experience what a metamorphosis the process of migration really is like. You're like in this eye of this hurricane, and it's a 6 month to sometimes year intense process where, you know, all your patterns of life, all your value systems, all your way of navigating spaces, the world, everything is, you know, changed in some format. And of course, the amazing thing is how quickly we adapt to it, right? So it's, I think it's very hard to explain to outsiders who haven't gone through that process what that culture shock makes it sound like. It's something at our end, but actually it's the world around us, right? It's not us, it's the world around us. So it's not an internal thing, it's an external thing to some extent. If I can go back to the question. pre-migration, I just want to, so having talked about that intense metamorphosis, pre-migration, I think what happens when you are someone who is immersed in one culture and that's where you're born and rooted is, you have this sense of depth, right? Because you observe everything keenly. You breathe it. It's values. I mean, I don't care what anybody tells themselves. Visiting any country for 2 weeks is not experiencing its culture, all right? So living there and actually living its values is. So pre-migration, I had that sense of depth. So in that case, that would be Dubai and just, you know, understanding Middle Eastern culture. I feel, of course, I don't think I can claim it to the same extent that a native Arabic speaker would do, but I do understand and read and write Arabic. So, you know, there's that depth that you get. What post-migration, I feel, from those two journeys has been instead a breadth. Because what I've been able to observe as a result are these patterns. These patterns where we're different, right? We all have very different cultures, Middle East, Southeast Asia, my own culture, South Asia, and now Australia. But there's patterns and there's connections. And seeing how those same things are changing across those cultures, across those cities, across those spaces, it helps you hover at a different level. And I think it helps you question in a way that when you're an insider, you never truly do. You never truly question the foundations of your own culture often, even as a migrant, until you leave your home culture. So that's what I find is different for me pre and post migration. And that's definitely something I bring into my work. I'm always the person that's willing to ask the question of the client or other person across the table. They're slightly pushing them out of their comfort zone and going, okay, this is how you do this. Why? And some people don't like that question. But, you know, when asked from a good place and respectfully, the answers are fascinating. And sometimes they're like, I'm not even sure why. You know, are there other ways of even doing this? And then that opens up a conversation. And that is brilliant. And that's where the magic happens for me. Agency. How do you manage agency when working in the field? Quite frankly, I don't remember who said this, but power is never given to you. You have to take it. So my early experiences in practice here were that all that knowledge and experience was denied in the sense of it was just degraded, not considered. You know, which is bizarre if you think about it, because apart from First Nations people, if you change the time frame, everyone here is a migrant. And so even the, you know, most of the built fabric is from a migrant built knowledge legacy, if you think about it. So that agency wasn't granted. And you know, when you're a migrant and you're dealing with so much, you go, okay, I don't know the lay of the land, so I'll play the good immigrant for a little bit and shush. But once you get the lay of the land, the innate cultural habit of, I suppose, having a bit of a, but why? There's at least in my culture, there used to be, may not always be the case, culture transforms, a healthy culture of debate. And so I didn't wait to be given that permission in those settings, whether it be a client meeting or a council meeting, very politely, very quietly, was very happy to speak up and go, oh, and have you considered this? And I can see why this has value, but have you, you know, here's another way it's done in another part of the world. And actually the climate is not as different as you think. And then you hear this silence and people go, I've never heard of this before. You know, so there's actually not that much pushback. So I didn't wait to be given those opportunities. I just jumped in there. Because, yeah, I just found that I had to wrestle it for myself to get that. And once I started and saw those reactions, I haven't stopped shutting up ever since.
Yeah, so I did have a bit of culture shock, but I was very fortunate to have, well, they're not my family, but people that I could come and live with who are Kenyan. And it was just like being at home, but it was really different once I stepped out the door. And I think that was something that really helped me to adjust at the beginning when I moved here. One thing that was really shocking was that sometimes I couldn't understand. So I worked at like a customer service job and I had to be on the phone to people with very thick Australian accents. And I have my very thick Kenyan accent at the time. There was definitely communication breakdown. And I had to, I haven't been speaking English that people can understand all this time. So that was a bit difficult for me at first. And that was a bit shocking. But aside from that, in terms of my lifestyle adjustment, as I said, I had a very like soft landing pad. I could eat all the same food that I used to eat back home. And I think that was really good. And it made me really appreciate community and kinship ties, even if it's not, you know, your blood family. You can have chosen family. And it's made me very open to other people who feel lost. And I feel like I'm very happy to sort of give them a soft landing when they come. And I guess that was in terms of work. So my experience pre-migration, I didn't know that there are things in my culture, in my lived experience, that could be very useful to the way I work and the like the design that I do or any academic writing that I do, because that wasn't really a thing. Like back in my undergrad education, we had all this knowledge and experience, but we still used to learn, like, let's say, history of landscape architecture through like the lens of American landscape architects, you know. And I guess when I came here is when I noticed that, oh, there are many, many things in my culture, my traditional culture and my lived experience and local knowledge that can be borrowed and injected into my academic and design work. So I only found that out after migration, which is a bit, you know, the irony in that is, you know, cannot be... yeah, so I guess that was a really big thing for me. And I think also we were immigrant guilt, which is something that a lot of people deal with. And I think that I'm still in the process of, you know, sort of processing how exactly that's going to play out in my life. Because the fact is that you do pay a lot of money for an international education, and it often comes at the cost of, you know, a big sacrifice from the people who are back home. So honestly, I'm still navigating that, but it's something that I think about often, and I empathize so much with people who have to move away, because then you feel like you have to give back. But then what about you? Like, it's a very complicated set of emotions that we have to go through. Yeah.
Maybe I can add a little bit as from the context of like Chinese the only daughter of the family, the only generation. So for Chinese girls, study abroad is more of like a family project rather than the decision that you can make by yourself. So usually the family decided their only daughter saying, oh, you can go study abroad. And that's such a privilege of like Chinese middle class families can have. And also usually the intention behind transnational education is because parents want their daughters to fight against a very masculine and nepotism within the working field back home. And this is something I experienced, like I guess I heard from my peers who went back after the graduation. They find it's really hard to get a job, but whereas in Australia, things are played very differently. So it's not about, it's still, I you must say there's still discriminations happen here, but things are not heavily based on who you are. If you're a young girl who is still not married, you might not get a job because they expect you to have kids in the future and you're going to take maternity leave. So things are different, but I guess it's also coming here, it's also a way to liberate your idea of your gendered life course, because Chinese girls, usually women, are usually follow a standard gendered life course saying you must get married before 30 and probably have your first kid at 30 years old. So these things, study abroad really allow me to rethink all these notions of what I really want to do. Is that something I really want to pursue or want to try something professional and maybe delay whatever other personal mandatory things that allowed back home? So I guess that's also something before and after that I experienced. Okay, so now we jump to the next question of, from your perspective, how has cultural exchange enabled you in your practice or study? And how crucial is migration for your practice?
Should I start? Okay. Yeah, I think I already touched on this a little bit, but I think, as I said, the whole bringing to light what I know, have known and experienced and lived as extremely important to my practice has been one of the major things that has happened after migration. But I think the other thing is having opportunities. I think that my opportunities after migration and moving here have been much wider. And I don't know whether that's because of the environment that I'm in or because of the transformation that has taken place in my mind to sort of feel like, oh, yeah, I can do this and I can talk about this in my work. And I think my approach now is very different. I think at the beginning I was scared to sort of speak up and say things about, that I know of. But now I feel much more confident in giving my opinion, and I value the input that I bring without feeling like I need to conform. So I feel like my difference and my unique point of view really lends to the richness and the quality of any work that I do.
That sounds so lovely, and I'm so glad it's been so positive. So unfortunately, I have the flip side to share. That does not negate, obviously, a positive experience. Never. I'm very thrilled when somebody has a better experience than myself. So cultural exchange. In the wider industry, it's been less exchange and more of a please do not proceed stop sign. There is this very pernicious, disingenuous attitude of, oh, that doesn't work here, which is, I'm going to try not to swear because my kids are in the back. Because at the end of the day, we forget. Yes, we have a temperate climate, but you know what? Our summers are really hot and they're going to get hotter. And we could learn from other parts of the world that have different climate systems. And you know what? A lot of the materials that we use in our built environment are used elsewhere in the world.
often for thousands more years than they've been used here. So I call BS on that. So that's what has often happened. There's been no willingness to actually let those ideas in on an actual built on site project level. And so I decided to fire my employer and set up my own practice, which is obviously not recommended always as the best way to proceed, but I was young. Today marks 10 years exactly of the day that we set up our practice. Thank you. I don't know whether I recommend firing your boss to everybody. But anyway, so in private practice then, this slips in unconsciously. And it's always, always this attitude and of actually going, those built knowledges from India and the Middle East, which is where I grew up, they have a lot that can cross-pollinate here. And that's not to say that my encounters here of the way we build here and the way we execute projects here has not influenced me. It absolutely has. On a very fundamental level, some things are used as structure and ornament. Here, they're used only as a skin. And often, it's when I try to hybridize the two or cross-pollinate the two that something interesting happens. Bizarrely enough, the least resistant people have actually been people on site. The people who are actually building the things with their own hands are often the least resistant to going there with me, which is interesting. It's not the cohort you would expect. So that's how I suppose it has now enabled me in my practice. I think it's really helped us unlock a different way of seeing our projects. And how crucial is migration for our practice? Really, I feel like this is a question for every practitioner, because as I said, as far as I'm concerned, everyone here is operating from a migrational legacy. Doesn't matter if you're first, third, fourth generation, right? The built environment fabric here is based on a Western European, British, built tradition. Somewhat actually, if you think about it, very poorly adapted to the climate at first, and which is good. We now get to retrofit those buildings. So, to me, this is a question that shouldn't be specifically asked of a first generation migrant person. Actually, we should ask that of our whole built environment industry, because First Nations people are currently still undertaking the hard work of telling us about their knowledge and legacies and built legacies, and we only know a tiny fraction, and we don't have a right to know everything. So that's my response to that question. Sorry for bringing the mood down.
I'll go in the middle then. So yeah, I think it's a bit of a both. There's positive, there's negative. Being exposed to different cultures and working in different setting bring you, like you said, that you start to question things and you just don't take things for granted. Or is it really how you do things? So that's definitely kind of like what I feel as well. And then sometimes when you say that in the office that you just join anywhere, and then it's probably easier now. 15 years ago, probably I looked like some 17 years old or something that tried to convince someone on site how to do things. And so that's always...
Most people on site are actually 17, if you think about it, the apprentices.
So that was kind of like, try to, it's the being, so I lost my train of thought now. No, all good, but it's basically, it's very, very, you start to question things to sort of see in a different way. And then when someone, doesn't matter like what I feel is younger, older, senior, it's always something to learn from them. And then I don't always get the same treatment. So sometimes, or I don't know whether that's being, a woman in industry when the room full of men, for example, I'm not talking specifically here, probably stronger in Asia. So it's, someone expert from Europe or somewhere, say one thing, everyone say that's, yep, that is correct, that is a great idea. And then someone younger that probably very competent, but from Asia, with a dark skin or whatever. And then it's, you have to really to be on top of your game all the time, proving that you are really good to be in the same level as them. So that's, it's just part of it. But it's, I felt it very strongly early in the career that you just have to be, you just have to know what you're doing every time. Just, yeah, it's much, a lot pressure in the beginning, and then it gets easier and easier. And as it, you know, 5-6 years down the road, and I start to feel like, well, if you don't believe it, just you'll see what's going to happen. You know, like you start to feel, you have the confidence, and then you know how to navigate through that conversation in the work kind of setting, and then things just get easier. So I know how to speak with someone who actually probably in the beginning belittling you a little bit, you know, just because how you look or where you come from, you know, like, where do you study? Or in one of, oh, from there, you know, it's not spoken, but you can see from their eyes kind of like scanning you up and down. So that's the negative side of kind of cultural exchange in the experience that I had. But the positive side of things, and it's, you know, like move to Scotland, move to New Zealand. New Zealand was probably, yeah, it's such a unique place. I love working there. It was so sad to leave. Such a great time. I think I love learning from, you know, I'm indigenous myself from Indonesia, and then there's always something so unique design and architecture wise that actually the modern kind of thinking of architecture, you don't have to keep on finding your solution of things. Ask the locals. They know, they've been doing it for hundreds of years, and they know how the best way of to solve these things. And then, so if you willing to engage with the people and the local expert, actually your project can move better. So I think that's yeah, my experience is that. I know if anyone want to
actually, I do want to add one other thing about cultural exchange. Remember I was here, I was talking about the lack of depth. One thing that has frustrated me is that I don't know whether to call it ham-fisted or whatever, but often cultural exchange seems to start and end with food. I am not my food. And I just need to say that. We can chat about more than recipes. Ask me about the built tradition. Ask me about other things. Of course, you don't, may not have, feel like you have the right to know, but sometimes it's nice to go beyond those layers.
Well, I guess maybe I'm having a positive experience because I'm not in practice. Yeah. well, I am, but I don't deal with the big bosses that shoot you down. Yeah, so I think for me, something that's been a bit negative in the cultural exchange part is working up the confidence to have a contrary opinion. I think you both of you have had the, I guess, the negative and then become strong and then been able to, you know, face your opponent or whatever. But for me, I think I'm still at that phase where if I have a contrary opinion, sometimes it's difficult to voice it when you're surrounded by many similar opinions. I think that's still something that I'm trying to navigate. Yeah, so I would say that that's something that I have grappled with in the past. But I think that as I continue to know more about my work and myself, I'm becoming more and more confident. And yeah, even to sit on a panel like this and talk to so many people, I think putting myself out there is making that process more and more seamless. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Maybe I'll also add a little bit. So just this is a piece of advice for, I guess, students. Just never overlook your embodied knowledge. I have this experience of taking a contemporary history subject, and where they have an essay talking about contemporary Chinese gated residential communities where I grew up. So I was really shocked to see there are actually people studying this kind of things that I grew up in my grandparents' house. So those typologies are really useful in helping us understand the history and also help us solve the problems of the futures. So yeah, just always remember what you come with Never forget that. Okay.
As a migrant built environment designer, how do you navigate your own privileges and disadvantages? For example, maybe language and cultural knowledge?
I'm happy to go first on this one. So I would say definitely it's important to reflect on the privileges here. And I suppose my biggest privilege has been my command of the English language. It has been an advantage here. And also, I now realize an accent that seems different, but that clearly people could grasp. So that has been a privilege. And the other privilege actually is the ability to have made these journeys, actually, on some level, because I realized that that itself also is a privilege. Many people do not have that option ever in life. So having made these multiple journeys, I deeply realized the privilege of those journeys. And so the privilege that that has given me, I feel, is like this, you know, Marvel XL X-ray vision glasses that helps me do that questioning and cross-pollination. And it just enables you to cut through quickly to the core of things. So those to me are privileges. There's not a lot of faffing about and you know, getting stuck with roadblocks, I feel, because I feel I can filter those things quicker as a result of those migration journeys. Disadvantages? I suppose I mentioned earlier feeling like a unicorn within the unicorn, right? So Ghassan Haj, who is an amazing anthropologist, talked about being a migrant as occupying two places at the same time simultaneously. And sometimes that in-between purgatory can be a lonely place because you're neither here nor there. You adapt to this new culture. You're never fully an insider for quite some time. Maybe my children will be. And you go back and you're never the same that you were. So it can be kind of this interesting existence. I think that's probably what I want to end on.
Yeah, sure. So I think one of my privileges that I think is everyone's privilege is there's this common saying that no one is you and that is your power. Like, it's very cliche, but it's very true. Like, no one can bring the same... I believe that no one can bring the same value to anything that I can. No one can have the same view. No one can have the same input as me. And sometimes when I'm feeling a bit, oh, I don't know how I'm... You know, I think that the fact that I'm myself and I have different, you know, experiences, different outlook, I think that's something that I now realize is a privilege and that I appreciate about myself. And I guess the other thing is, I don't know whether this is positive, but I don't like competing. Like, competition is not something that is ever on my mind. Like, and I think that's a privilege because sometimes you can get, I guess, taken off course by what's going on around you. So I think for me, something that's a big privilege is that sometimes competition doesn't exist on my mind. And that helps me to just try and become better than I was before instead of focusing on all the things that are going on around me. Disadvantages, sometimes they do get you down. You know, sometimes you have to fight a bit harder for something that other people would be able to get a bit easier. But at the same time, if I remember that, you know, I'm myself and I can add something unique, then I think, well, the disadvantages don't simply melt away, but it helps you to deal with the situation in which you're in at the time. And also having a teachable spirit, like a willingness to learn and a willingness to grow, I think is something that helps during disadvantage. It helps you navigate situations or in a more informed manner. Just because you're willing to, you know, put aside what you do know, maybe redirect your course. And I guess that's been a big tool for me. Yeah.
Privilege. I feel privileged to be here. That's just to, as a sort of not many, I think, coming from Indonesia, it's not easy to just go outside and find a job and all of those. So I feel very privileged to be able to choose where I go now. You know, that's a very different place to be. And feel very privileged that I still actually enjoying what I do. 'Cause some people just, that's just day-to-day kind of thing. But I do enjoy what I do. And if you're lucky, the project that you do every day, it's just bring smile to your faces. That's not happen every day, but those day happens. And so in terms of this advantage, an immigrant can be hard because at times you always feel like you're one step behind than everyone else because there's a probably language barrier. So I can't remember how many times I have to take TOEFL or IELTS test just to prove that I can speak English properly. Like, my English is not perfect, but, you know, I finished my master's all right. And but, you know, every time, and I've been working for 10 years, and then I wanted to study again. They said I have to take IELTS again, although I've been practicing in English-speaking country for those 10 years, which I think that is, wow, okay. So then... yeah, so that's something that I don't know. If I want to study now, I probably have to take again. And other things as well. So sort of like visa is another thing. So many things that we have to tick boxes as compared to probably here for Australian. You know, like we have to have this. Everything have to be in a good order for a company to probably to hire, to... many administration kind of... documents that we have to go through more. So you have to step behind in that. And in terms of working, I think moving from one place to another, for me at least, new regulation, new standard of design, I have to know. You guys know how many Australian standards that exist here. Boy, oh boy, I'm just like, there's another standard I have to learn, you know. So moving from one place to another, so I feel like I have to then again, learn that. But that's my decision to move, so I don't mind learning those. It's just something that I think 10 years from moving Singapore and, you know, from Singapore and other places, I get to know that it's actually more or less the same. It's just the details that is different. And I think, but what we... Something that I kind of learned is basically 80% of my professional work has been in foreign land. So that means I'm always a guest to everybody else. So, and that unconsciously, I always tread carefully. I always try to, you know, kind of do anything that I do that I say will offend other culture, other people. And I found that something is actually a good attitude to have, especially here. I guess many of us here, or most of us actually, although you probably are Australian, but you are still a guest to this country, right? So we are a guest here to local Aboriginal people, and that's a good attitude to have here. So I think like that's something that I'm happily taking that kind of thread carefully, lesson learned from moving places that I will kind of hold on to, and definitely make me more resilient as well. So changes places. Yeah, sure, no problem. I survived a few times before. Something uncomfortable is fine. You know, so it's something that definitely very, very good experience to have. Yeah.
Sorry, can I add one more thing? Thank you for this great question, actually, because all of us can ponder our privileges. And there's nothing... A lot of people feel very uncomfortable with that word. But the best thing is, once you've done that, reflecting on what your privileges are, you go, then what do I do with it, right? And so the decision I made, because at that time there certainly were many sole practitioners that were of immigrant backgrounds is I just decided to not be invisible because I had the privilege of having my own practice. So every time Justine at the back or someone else said, hey, do you want to come and talk? Yes, I fought imposter syndrome, still am, and just turn up and start talking. And so because I realized you can't be what you can't see. And so that's been what I've tried to do with that. And then the other thing I've tried to do is for the past 7 years, every opportunity anyone has ever said, hey, do you have time for a coffee? And I've said yes. And I've mentored, I think, about 30 people at this point, most of immigrant background. So, you know, it's what you do with it is what matters. There's nothing wrong with the word.
That is such a nice response. Thank you, Sonia. So we're finished with our questions. So now we just want to ask our speakers one piece of advice that you want to have, for example, young practitioners or immigrants. Advice, just. We can expand that because we have a lot of time. Yeah. Advice.
Okay, I can go first. To anyone who's an international student at the moment, I know it's scary, especially when you think about all the things that you need to do. You don't have a visa, you don't have a job, you don't have a place to stay, rent is crazy. Like, there's so many challenges. But I would say believe in yourself. Like, actually believe in yourself. Like, believe that you move to a different country and you can make it. Like, you've made it through whatever time of study, you know, you've done the late nights, you've done the work, you have like what it takes, you have the qualifications. So just believe in yourself and put yourself out there. But in saying that, it's find a community that you actually like. So like there's this whole thing that we're told, yeah, make sure you network. But don't be the person just texting random people on LinkedIn. Don't do that. Find people that you actually like, that you actually want to talk to, that you actually connect with. And those are the people that are going to help you along your journey because they actually care about you. But if it's a random person on LinkedIn, they've got a million other things to do. So just make sure that you invest your energy. And it can be frustrating. Like if you send 10 texts on LinkedIn and no one's replying back to you, you can be like, oh, what's wrong with me? But if you actually put time into people that care about you, then they're gonna, you know, be more invested in you. And I guess the other thing is that you moved all the way from your country to come to a different country, a beautiful country with many beautiful things. And I'm personally still working on this. But go out and see it. Do other stuff that's not work, that's not school, that's not uni. You know, do other things that pique your interest. If you like music, you know, go to a concert or whatever. Like, do something else because we can honestly be so caught in the rat race and you're constantly worrying about the next thing. Oh, am I going to get kicked out? Am I going to have rent? Like, there's so many worries. But the fact that you came all this way from your country and you're now in a different place, you have the chance, you can do things that you love, that you enjoy. Yeah, and I always say work is work and life is life. And those are two different things. You can be too focused on your work such that you're missing out on your life. And I don't think it's worth it in the end. So, yeah, that's it for me.
Actually, I feel like I'm going over some of what some of the brilliant stuff Karen has said. So I'm just going to build off her point about worth and just remind you that no one else gets to determine your worth. Only you do. So embrace the skin of a rhino. A sari certainly helps. And remember that a career is, particularly in the built environment, because we seem to work until we fall over our drawing boards, it's a marathon, not a sprint. So resist the temptation to pause and look around and go, where am I in the race? No. Run your own race. It's going to look very different from others. That's it.
let your work do the talking. So that's something that my mom said, that it might take time, but the quality of your work will do the talking, and someone and other people can see it and then they appreciate it. And it's very hard in the beginning of the career that to get exactly what you want, or you actually probably don't know what you want. So be patient. I think it took me 7-8 years to find what I really actually like doing in the umbrella, under the umbrella of design. And don't rush it. It might go right or left. You know, I started as an architect, end up I don't know how many thousand kilometers from Indonesia doing something else. So it's, yeah, enjoy the process and don't, you know, there's another quote before, when I was still dancing a lot, it's dance to express, not to impress. So it's the same thing. So design to express yourself. Don't try to impress others. That's all.
This is something I wrote down, but it's quoting from Sonia. There's a AIA special issues that came out last September. It's called Migration, Women and Architecture. In that issue, Sonia mentioned find your role model or your mentor. You can't be who you can't see. So I guess for students and young graduates, I think it's very important to always challenge your limits and to see what other people are doing. And you maybe 5 years later, you'll see you're way better than them. So just always try to reach the ceiling, but try to locate where you are, perhaps, and then maybe find your role model. Yeah.
I'm just going to jump on the wagon and just say, just be kind to yourself when you're going through this journey. And yeah, just be kind to yourself and to others. And that's kind of the end of our questions. We're going to turn it to the audience now. Thank you so much for being a great audience. Do you have any questions for our speakers?
Thank you very much. Hi, my name's Evie. I'm curious to know what your perspective of, as say a customer or designing for a immigrant customer, whether you think architecture caters for migrants here. If so, how do they do it? Or if not, what are they lacking?
I feel this can apply just as much to landscape. I will say this, because being a migrant or migration is so intertwined with culture, I think we have to realize that culture is always a moving beast. And so is where that experience of migration is. So what I mean to say is, often the mistake I see that is being brought in engaging, say, with immigrant clients, is the assumption that their position on their culture is static. Often they're on a very different point. Often, look, I hate the word assimilation because it's so oppressive to me. But often they are at a certain different point on where they see what they want from their culture in their project. Does that make sense? And I might come to it with a false lens that they want to see a lot more of it. So I have to resist the urge to go that your perception of where you are in your culture is the same point that I am at, you know, and simply because I'm wearing a sari doesn't mean that, you know, my understanding of my culture hasn't evolved. So similarly, just because they're an immigrant client, I don't want to take that for granted. I have to meet them at where they are at. I think so. Often, I suppose the on the flip side of that, what I often find is this discomfort when either people across the table is not from an immigrant background to go there. You know, to assume that the person of immigrant background doesn't want to express themselves. So then, in return, the client becomes reticent. Does that make sense? So it's a lot more nuanced, I think. And I think even as an immigrant designer, I don't take that for granted, that I will have a special insight.
because it's a point in time and it's fluid and it can change. Certainly, my connection with my culture has changed so much since having children. You know, you loop back, then you question some of the, you know, stuff and go, why is it like this? And you move forward and, you know, it's quite fluid, that experience. So I do want to say it's a complex thing and not something even I feel entitled to take for granted. And I don't think it's catered well for, yes. And sometimes it can feel unsafe to share that with a designer. Because they can very quickly devalue that. So I'm a professional, as I said, right? And so my knowledge can be devalued even though I'm trained. And so imagine a layperson trying to offer those things and being brushed off going, oh yeah, but that doesn't work here. Then they lose that confidence as a client.
Yeah, it's probably the nature of the projects that sort of I've been involved in is a little bit different in that sense. That's kind of, so for the past sort of 10 years or so, my client's almost not human in a way. That's like, it's a conservation project. So the end of, you know, the client's actually either the birds, now my clients are elephants. And so it's a very different way of approach in design. And it's completely a flip in my head when I started, I studied architecture, so everything is very human-centric. It is very, and I love vernacular architecture, and being part from Indonesia, there's so many cultural in architecture from different kind of, you know, provinces in Indonesia that are very interesting, and then the technique can be adopted into like modern architecture, you can say that way. But, you know, moving to landscape and then moving to environmental project, then I think I kind of feel that I'm further and further away stepping from that kind of context and more into a wider sort of, you know, ecology and ecosystem and that sort of place. And interestingly enough, that we always think that human culture is the center of things. And when you work in that kind of project, you are just a small piece of everything else. So human, animal, water, and all just kind of has the same weightage almost. So I think that's a very different in my project experience, I guess.
Yeah. I think I haven't had much experience working with clients, but last year I took part in a studio where we had to work with the African refugee community, and I am African, but there were so many, well, I'm Kenyan, and there's so many other Africans. And even going in, it was difficult for me to grasp exactly what these clients want. But and I was part of a bigger group, like a bigger group of students who weren't even African. But I think at the end of the day, it was really important to sort of immerse ourselves in their needs, like their culture and their everyday comings and going, and sort of really be sincere about what we want to do. And I think that's the most important thing when designing for migrants, is actually immersing yourself and actually listening to what they want, despite the fact that you might have some knowledge. Listening will actually reveal all the things that are important to them. And I do think there's a gap for those, because there's also the gap in listening, the gap in asking, oh, so what actually do you want? And I think once because we stayed there for like an entire week, and we learned the things that were important to them, and then we were able to direct our projects, I think they seemed quite happy with them. But we were able to direct our efforts to what they actually cared about and not what we thought that they cared about.
Actually, Karen's point reminded me something. The approaches in a private brief to a public brief are very different. So particularly with a public brief, that deep listening often should, but doesn't always, result in a certain looseness. As architects, we tend to over-design. It really backfires when you're dealing with diverse migrant communities. If you do that over-designing, you end up excluding a lot more people than you realize. So that ability to swallow our ego and go one or two steps back and leave that looseness in the how that design is used, how it's resolved, actually, I think those are good things. So the approaches are different in public and private.
Thanks very much. Having been an I'm a migrant of 26 years, and it was interesting sitting here and talking about your experiences and kind of comparing it to some of the experiences that I had. And as you say, we all have different stories. I'd just be interested in, you know, you've all either studied or practiced in other countries, and I'm sure you're all pretty widely read as to where design sits in different parts of the world. And I wonder, could you reflect on where you think we are strong in Australia and where we need to have the humility to go and say, actually, it's done better in another place?
One I can say is for sure, like, attention to detail, standard and regulation here is they're really good as compared to back home. And it's like a plus and minus thing. When you practice, you know, I practice in Indonesia, the lack of regulation, the lack of that give designer more freedom in a way. But it's probably dangerous down the road, because then you jump so many holes to get what you want, and then you get there, the build, you know, the project is like what you wanted, but it's actually probably not cater for you know, all the requirement, like the for wheelchair and accessibility, for example. I feel it's really good here, excellent in Singapore too. And if you have small kid, you have pram, that is, you know, ramps everywhere. It's just, I never really noticed ramps before, but when you have little baby, you start doing that. And it's just in Indonesia, that sort of thing, the planning and everything, it's lacking. And I've been only in Australia for 2.5 years, so I probably, Sunia can tell more about it. But yeah, in just a short amount of time practicing here, it's actually quite similar to Singapore in standard, and then attention to detail, and then just the step-by-step of regulation that you have to clear before actually you do something. That's not much happened in Indonesia, but I was working in Indonesia almost 20 years ago, so it was a long time ago though, so it could be very different, and things are, I think, it's more well-regulated now. Do you want to add?
That's a really tough question to answer in short notice. I feel like I'd have so much preferred that to have been emailed to me instead. But great question. The first answer I can give is something that I have often mulled over. And that is, you know, architecture cannot, simply because of the costs of the stuff we deal with, be separated from capital, right? So my observations are tied to those connections between labor and material. And so what I find our strengths here, because our labor costs are relatively higher than other parts of the world, is that precision that Anning mentioned. I mean, it blew my tiny mind when somebody told me that most construction tolerances are within 5 mil. I was like, really? You know, in other parts of the world, 20, 50 mil is quite acceptable. You're kind of almost there. 5 mil tolerance, pretty darn good. Where does that come from? A very, very tightly managed labor schedule and a very, very clear delineation of what's happening on site. Why? Because you can't afford to waste that time off the labor on site. In, out, know what you're doing, build it exactly. Okay, stuff up, clear up slightly. You know, it's tied so much to that labor cost, which is the complete opposite in, you know, India and the Middle East, where the cost of labor is a fraction compared to often the material. And so, of course, on the flip side, sometimes you actually see more expensive materials being used, but I won't go there. But what I find there, though, is as a result of that, there is actually a lot more innovation, because there is a willingness to go, because you're not working for that 5 mil tolerance. You're working for something that stands up, stands well, is robust. You know, you're not worried so much about movement and those kind of things. So there is a willingness to prototype on site and try new things in a way that I have found that only the most top end of town can indulge in here on a design basis. And occasionally, it definitely happens in public projects on site. But definitely I find that as a result of those connections between labor and construction cost, et cetera, that there is a lot more willingness to experiment. And on the flip side, having said that, a big proportion of projects in the other part of the world where labor costs are not as high also mean that budgets are not as big. So you actually learn to really, really push cheap materials to their limit. You know, concrete's cheaper in some parts of the world, but even in some parts of the world, concrete's too expensive. So you're pushing hard to look for other materials and to make them work, to hybridize them. So I think those are my observations in the short span of time in a tricky question.
I think with regard to school and education is that probably Australia does well providing resources to students. So if you're at a uni, you probably have access to a lot more than most other people in the world could ever dream of. And yeah, an example of that is like access to journals. So in my entire undergrad, like I didn't have access to any journals at my uni. And now I realize that that's abnormal. It's not like how you're expected to do research if you don't have access, like if your university doesn't pay for journals. So I think, the resources are a big thing. But I think a lot of the world does like climate responsiveness better than Australia. Yeah, so like a lot of vernacular, architecture and a lot of vernacular methods are like so much better and simpler and better for the planet. But sometimes because of the standards, you can't do some of that stuff here. So, yeah.
I'm going to piggyback off that excellent point to actually say, I have to say, the industry here is so wasteful. The amount of waste I see go from a skip in front of a typical renovation gives me anxiety. I am constantly looking at the skip going, does that need to go? Can we reuse that? It's just this mentality of how could you let that go to waste? You know, I mean, I look at the Mavis peanut jars and I go, great, future spice jars. Do you know what I mean? So that we have a very wasteful attitude to construction here, which is quite shocking, to be honest.
I have a question. Like, it's quite an international student question. What approach and how much time do you recommend to spend on learning the plant communities and their natural habitat when you move to another part of the world, like from the tropical area to the temperate area? You need to know like totally different community, plant community and ecology. Is how do you study it and how much time do you need to spend on it?
Excellent question. It's an ongoing project. So that's on the dot because it's very difficult. Growing up in the tropics, working 10 years in the tropics, all my plant library in my head are tropical. And then I move to other part of the world and that just can't be used at all. So it is very long and I'm still learning, since moving here. And I would say the tropical plant library are much bigger than everywhere else. So if you start there, somehow it's easier to move to other places because like it's just kind of a fewer species to sort of get to know. But it doesn't kind of take the point that you're making that you move to other. So because I love working in that kind of project and then I have to know that. And then so it took me 3-4 years to sort of get comfortable in sort of, you know, like tropical and wetland and that sort of lowland forest stuff. And then I felt comfortable there and suddenly, okay, let's move elsewhere. And then that haven't used since. So they haven't been used since. So it's a new thing again. So it's really hard for me to pinpoint the number of years that you have to invest. But
you know, like if you want to move somewhere, the plus side is the approach of the design and the approach of the understanding of the habitat and ecosystems are the same. The framework is the same. So, and then there's always someone in your office or the specialist of that's really a plant specialist that would help you. So landscape architect is not a horticulturist either, yeah. Right? Yeah. So it's a plus to have that knowledge, but you don't have to know every single plant in the world.
Connect the landscape ecology to the culture. Do you think it's important to use the indigenous vegetation as a method to express the First Nation culture or something?
Use indigenous plant as, sorry?
To use plant as a material to express the culture.
Express the culture. Oh, interesting. I think plants as part of culture. So that's the first time I probably kind of hear it. That's an interesting way to use that. I see that, so in the project, environmental project, plants, indigenous plants are always good because the local, you know, the animals will actually go for indigenous plants, right? And then they're lowering costs for maintenance because that's how the nature, you know, they just balance out themselves in the wild. So that's the choice for in terms of cost management and maintenance and all sort. But expression of culture, that's used a lot in Southeast Asia to sort of, you probably heard it, the Bali vibe, the resort vibe. So that says, my clients say that a lot. I want this Bali resort vibe in my garden. So, and that has become sort of an expression that is interesting. That's probably, like you said, it's a culture, but that's true. That's what people see in a probably brochure magazine. So, you know, like, or desert somewhere, like it's arid, you know, that sort of thing as a part of culture. But I think that's what I said, if plants used as a setting of environment to bring some, setting off that is not there. So probably you want to bring tropical elsewhere in the world that still possible. You don't want to take it to Scotland, for example. They will not survive. But yeah, so that's definitely you can do that. Yeah.
I think I just add, just like, don't stress about it. It's going to be fine. Like, when I moved from Kenya, obviously I studied landscape architecture in Kenya, so I know all Kenyan plants. And then when I moved here, I couldn't take a landscape class because I was given an exemption. And then it meant that I skipped over that part of, you know, learning Australian plants. And now I started working. Yeah, I know. And then I started working. And you know what? There's so many resources online. Like, when you're on a project, you can look it up and it's going to be fine. And when you do it for a bit and you're walking, now you can identify them. I think it's not something to be worried about. Yes, put effort into it, but it's not like a do or die. Like, you have to know 200 Australian plants before I apply for a job. Like, no, it's going to be fine, yeah.
And I'm not entitled at all to talk about plants because I don't know landscape architecture, but at least in terms of trying to engage with culture, I think you can take some of the pressure off yourself because the whole built environment industry is only at its very first baby steps at trying to engage with First Nations culture. And the culture we're talking about here is First Nations culture, right? So we are very early in that path. So do not put that pressure on yourself when there are practitioners 3 or 4 decades along who are still clueless. And it is hard because it takes time and energy from First Nations people to put that knowledge out there. And we don't, as I said, have a right to get to know it all instantly. So patience, young Padawan, and take the pressure off yourself. It's very freeing. Just listen. It's a great time to listen.
Thank you.
I wanted to start by saying thank you because, first off, as a woman in design, and second of all, as an immigrant woman in design, it's hard not to tear up hearing other women's stories about this sort of thing. I think most powerfully, how do you not lose yourself? How do you want to integrate and be Australian and want to join this community without losing who you are in it?
Well, I feel comfortable going into this because I've mulled this a little bit as a parent. So I could feel the catch in your voice. Thank you for speaking up. I think the fact that there's so many people here says something to me too. But the thing I take courage from and that I don't lose from is that same matrilineal heritage and lineage that brought you here. I have drawn a lot of strength from the preceding women in my family. And you also have incredible women in your family lineage who have navigated extremely difficult challenges, right? So draw strength from them because you are as strong as every single one of them. Patriarchy is just a different flavor and in a different era right now, right? It's not disappeared just because we're in a different land. So draw strength from that matrilineal heritage, if I can encourage you to. And also know that your contribution is really, really going to make a difference to someone. You will not get that reflected back to you in the short term, but there will be a moment in time down the track where that gift will come back to you and you will feel what a gift that is to have made that difference. And that's where you'll draw strength from. So hang in there. But of course, that does not mean you tolerate the nonsense that comes your way. Yeah? Remember, the nonsense is systemic. You do not attract it and you do not cause it. It is done to you. Does that help?
Okay, the last question.
Second question. As immigrants to this country, have you felt safe and welcomed by the architecture that you've seen here? Do you relate to it at all?
I think, personally, a lot of the architecture in itself, it's very imposing. It doesn't make me feel welcome, but a lot of the stuff that's not built makes me feel very welcome. So living in a place with access to so much public space, especially within the city, because I live in the city, it really helps and it really grounds me in the sense that even when everything else feels overwhelming, I can retreat to a place that's not built, that doesn't have because you experience, like I've experienced a lot of difficult moments within buildings from, you know, racist people. A lot of difficulty sometimes navigating those, I guess, closed spaces. But when I go to a lot of open and public space where I can be by myself or with my friends and I don't have to pay anything, like I can just exist and be, that's very, I guess, soothing to my little immigrant soul. Yeah.
I will say, as an immigrant that has come also from a previous colonized country, it's a bit hard looking at a lot of the attitudes to heritage that prize a certain preserved in Botox time for a certain chunk of our built city. That definitely has not made me feel welcome. The attitudes to heritage, which is only heritage of a certain era, being quite valuable. So that doesn't make me feel welcome. Probably the closest thing is pretty close to what Karen said, public spaces and spaces that made you linger. I think Fed Square is probably a rare one because it jettisons a lot of baggage and language. You know, it just goes with geometry. Geometry has very less baggage compared to a lot of other things in the built environment. I mean, it's also part of why it's parts of NGV really echo because that monumentality and that just plain geometry is devoid of some of the baggage that I feel makes it feel unsafe for me. But I would say there are projects that have very recently built that I feel have been more welcoming. Again, because they're so much of a departure from what the majority of the built environment is. I think the closest one I can think of is... recently went to the Te Anak Center at Bujbim. It engages with First Nations culture and the amazing wetlands at Bujbim. And I cannot explain to you what a spiritual experience that was. I was in tears, and I'm not even First Nations. It is because it connected to a part of me that is very deeply connected to my village back in India. And it helped me really get close to the water, really think of every bit of soil and stone that was there. And it was so light. It was so light in how it sat on the site. It was so light in how it dealt with material and detail. And it was that lightness that helped me just let all parts of myself out, which I can't actually do in a lot of the built environment. Yeah, those are my reflections on that.
I feel like, so from, maybe I speak more from the landscape point of view, I think landscape is, I feel definitely more connected to landscape than to a building. And it's, having said that, I guess I see a shift in Melbourne, probably in terms of how the designer or landscape architect or urban designer design the open spaces here, the acknowledgement of the first country and way of thinking, and it's just ingrained more since the beginning of the project, and then as compared to, you know, say 15 years ago. Feel like it's more open and sort of inclusive, but I can't say more on building just yet. I don't feel that yet in terms of architecture, and I'm probably not the right person to say that because I work more in landscape. But definitely, there's a lot more conversation than I feel like in landscape and in Melbourne as compared to other cities. So I really love how designed in New Zealand is approached the Maori knowledge, and it's given, you know, like it's just part of the design since the beginning. It's non-negotiable, and it's just the common practice. And I'm really willing to hoping to see that going that direction here. I don't know how long it takes, but it will be beautiful to see. Yeah.
And this is why it is so valuable to have a landscape architecture perspective, because that is a truly deserving and damning assessment of architecture, actually. Because Buj Bim, if you go and look up the project images, is way more about the landscape than it is about the building, actually. So what is that saying about architecture? We truly deserve that criticism, by the way. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming. What a great discussion. Thank you again to our speakers.
You've been listening to an M-Pavilion podcast recorded on the lands of the Eastern Kulin Nation. For more, visit our archive at mpavilion.org and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.